content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello and welcome to Heard Any Good Books Lately? A program from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm George Douglas. This program is brought to you by the Friends of the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped, an organization of citizens, volunteers, and patrons, all interested in supporting the library and the services it provides. The Friends Group was founded in 1989 and now has more than 300 members across North Carolina. If you'd like to join the Friends Group yourself, we'll have information on how to do that at the end of this program. But this program is all about books, with special emphasis on those available from the North Carolina Library for the Blind. The library has more than 86,000 titles in its collection. Books and magazines are available in large print, braille, and talking books as well. The library has more than 11,000 patrons across the state, and if you're not a patron but are interested in becoming one, I'll have more information at the end of this program as well. This month, we'll take a look at some of the most popular books checked out during the months of March and April 2018 at the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. Now, our first book for today is called To Be Where You Are by the very popular author Jan Caron, and this is a review done by Andrew Spencer, and is taken from the Ethics and Culture blog. Spencer writes, "I've wrestled for years with my ongoing enjoyment of Jan Caron's stories about Mitford, North Carolina, and the hijinks of the population of that mythical town. After all, I've got an undergraduate degree in English literature and now a PhD. Certainly, I should prefer cutting-edge masterpieces that might someday find their way into the literary canon and are laced with esoteric symbolism. It might be all right if I dip my toes into the mystery stories of someone like Dorothy Sayers, who has the academic respectability of an M.A. from Oxford. But it can't be okay to enjoy light fiction like Caron's, can it? Well, I've decided there is good reason for all of us to like Caron's stories, even if they don't rise to the level of literary sophistication of a postmodern novel. And perhaps that is another solid reason for us enjoying them with integrity. Caron's stories tell a beautiful story well, reveal something of what it is to be human, and leaves us longing for a better world. She has created a world that struggles with the same sullied circumstances that surround our reality, but she weaves in an ever-present theme of hope. Caron shows us what life with hope looks like. Her latest book, To Be Where You Are, picks up very shortly after her 2015 novel, Come Rain or Come Shine, which told the story of the wedding of Dooley and Lace. This story seems to focus on Lace and Dooley, too, but it weaves in significant storylines from Father Tim and Cynthia. For those who have followed the series from the beginning, this volume manages to involve most of the major characters and bring memories to surface through brief vignettes and casual comments about their activities. In that sense, this volume is like comfort food that reminds us of home and makes the reader feel warm inside. Much like In the Company of Others, there is no major movement in the plot of To Be Where You Are. However, unlike the novel set in Ireland, Caron's latest effort is a page-turner. Every chapter leaves the reader wondering what will happen next and earnestly wanting to know. The difference is that To Be Where You Are deeply explores that sense of longing for companionship that unites the human experience. Her explosion of this primal theme through people at many stages of life pulls the reader in and makes this a thoroughly enjoyable book. Without giving some of the more intriguing plot twists away, the theme of companionship comes through on many levels. We see the struggles of newlyweds, Dooley and Lace, as they try to figure out boundaries, communication, and all the things that tend to lead to tension after weddings. They continue with the process of adopting the young child, Jack, who first appeared in the previous story. J.C. Hogan has to work on his level of romantic effort to avoid losing Adele due to indifference. Father Tim and Cynthia explore their unique roles post-retirement, but continue to grow together. These are just some of the many relationships that continue to highlight the desire of friendship, love, and family. To be where you are reminds us that it is just about enough in life to have someone that loves us. We need food, clothing, and shelter, of course, but humans are social creatures who continually yearn for a sense of belonging. The message is fairly clearly revealed. Company is better than accomplishment, and the comfort of love needs to be enjoyed, cultivated, and treasured. In this volume, Karen again explores some of the difficult life issues many of us face. Money troubles, family tension, professional stress, death, infertility, and longing. Writing as a Christian, Karen could easily give in to the temptation to simply pray the struggles away, but she doesn't. The gospel is evident both through explicit statement and repeated examples, but it is seldom presented in a heavy-handed way. Instead of simply making every hard-hearted character experience salvation by the end of the book, Karen just keeps providing illustrations of what the gospel might look like in life. She keeps pointing toward what it looks like to live with hope. That is true throughout the Mitford novels, but in this volume she shows us how living with a sense of gospel hope can help us to love other people, even the unlovely. And that's the power of this volume. Karen does a masterful job in showing the readers a small piece of what it might look like to be an authentic gospel-saturated Christian. Not the sort who has his or her likeness enshrined in a cathedral window, but the sort of a Christian who lives a regular life and wakes up one day to hear the Master say, "Well done, thou good and faithful servant." Jan Karen is the number one New York Times best-selling author of the Mitford novels, featuring Episcopal priest Father Timothy Cavanaugh and the fictional village of Mitford. She's also the author of 12 other books, including a cookbook and several books for children. Karen lives in Charlottesville, Virginia. Again, that book is entitled To Be Where You Are by Jan Karen. By the way, that last name is spelled K-A-R-O-N. Jan Karen. I think you'll enjoy that one. It was number one during the month of April in popularity at the North Carolina Library for the Blind. Now we'll turn to a book by another very popular author here. This one is called Hardcore 24, a Stephanie Plum novel by who else? Janet Ivanovich. Here's the summary. Trouble comes in bunches for Stephanie Plum. First professional grave robber and semi-professional loon, Simon Diggory, won't let her take him in until she agrees to care for his boa constrictor, whose name is Ethel. Events take a dark turn when headless bodies start appearing across town. At first, it's just corpses from a funeral home and the morgue that have had the heads removed. But when a homeless man is murdered and dumped behind a church, Stephanie knows that she's the only one with a prayer of catching this killer. If all that is not enough, Diesel is back in town. Trenton's hottest cop, Joe Morelli, isn't pleased at this unexpected arrival, nor is Ranger, the high-powered security consultant who has his own plans for Stephanie. Another Stephanie Plum novel by Janet Ivanovich. It's called Hardcore 24. Next is a popular book, and it's one of those bookshots, those shorter books by James Patterson that are so popular these days at the Library for the Blind. This one is called The Store, and it starts out with a headline that says, "The Store is Watching You." Jacob and Megan Brandeis have gotten jobs with the mega-successful, ultra-secretive store. Seems perfect, seems safe, but their lives are about to become anything but perfect and anything but safe, especially since Jacob and Megan have a dark secret of their own. They are writing a book that will expose the store, a forbidden book, a dangerous book. And if the store finds out, there's only one thing Jacob, Megan, and their kids can do, run for their bloody lives, which is probably impossible because the store is always watching. That's a very popular book this past month by James Patterson. It is called The Store. The next book popular this past month at the Library for the Blind was Secrets in Death, another murder mystery, and this one's by J.D. Robb. I'm going to read a Kirkus review here that I think you'll enjoy. Lieutenant Eve Dallas investigates the murder of a gossip columnist whose death answers a thousand prayers. Eve's already fraught meeting with irritating forensic anthropologist Dr. Garnett De Winter at the fashionable watering hole De Ven turns abruptly worse when a woman staggers out of the ladies' room and bleeds out under her eyes. The victim, self-styled social information reporter Larenda Mars, had dirt on just about everyone who mattered, including, as it awkwardly turns out, the owner of Duven, who just happens to be Rourke, Eve's billionaire husband, and wasn't shy about digging under every rock and paying off or blackmailing possible informants for more. So although several witnesses and the security cameras, so ubiquitous in 2061 when this takes place, swiftly identifies a likely suspect, it's impossible to distinguish that well-muffled figure from dozens of other wannabe Mars slayers. Following their noses, Eve and her partner, Detective Amelia Peabody, focus on three of Larenda's marks: talk screen queen Annie Knight, baseball star Wiley Stamford, and teenage actress Missy Lee Durante. Larenda was indeed blackmailing them all over secrets worth killing to preserve, thus sparking the moral outrage Eve's never shy about revealing on behalf of blackmail victims, mostly trying to protect loved ones as much, maybe more, than themselves. But the nominal victim's insatiably feral nature makes it hard to work up an equal level of outrage over her murder or to feel much of a sense of closure when Eve plucks the perp from a crowded field of suspects who would all have been perfectly within their rights in shutting down the blackmail factory by fair means or foul. The 45th entry in this fleet easy reading series provides a dramatic opening scene, a second act guaranteed to raise your most self-righteous hackles, and a denouement even Rob must have recognized as an anti-climax. Again, that one is called Secrets in Death by J.D. Robb. Now let's turn to a book by Karen Kingsbury, who is always a popular favorite author here at the Library for the Blind. This one is entitled Brush of Wings, and it's part of the Angel Walking series. From number one New York Times bestseller author Karen Kingsbury comes the third and final novel in an unforgettable series about four friends and the divine intervention that changes their lives forever. Against the advice of her doctor, Mary Catherine moves to Uganda to work at a new orphanage there. Whatever time she has left, Mary Catherine wants to spend it helping children, especially since she is unable to have children of her own. The only problem is Marcus Dillinger, the Major League Baseball player she was never meant to fall in love with. But neither Marcus nor Mary Catherine's other friends, Tyler Ames and Sammy Dawson, know just how serious her heart condition is. Still, Marcus suspects something isn't right. After months of silence, a divinely timed letter from Mary Catherine leads him on a desperate life-or-death mission to get her to a U.S. hospital before time runs out. Meanwhile, as Sammy and Tyler prepare to marry, the group receives shocking news that changes everyone's plans. The team of angels walking is busier than ever in this epic battle between life and death, Brush of Wings is a poignant tale of love, sacrifice, and the power of faith. Again, this book is called Brush of Wings from the Angel Walking series. It's the third one, the final novel in this series, by Karen Kingsbury. Next, let's take a look at another book by a regular favorite here. This is called Barely Legal, and it's by Stuart Woods. Perennial bestseller Woods and veteran Hall, who've already teamed up to spin a yarn starring Teddy Fay, the ex-CIA operative gone spectacularly rogue, give New York attorney Stone Barrington's rising star partner and former client Herbie Fisher a case of his own. Not that it's really Herbie's case. He's just the lawyer at Woodman & Weld, who answers the phone when his colleague James Glick, stricken with appendicitis, is looking for someone, anyone, to take his place in the courtroom and appear on behalf of David Ross, a pre-law student at Columbia caught at a party with a pocketful of cocaine, whose father, a city councilman, has arranged a sweetheart plea bargain that will keep his son out of jail. The plea bargain is authentic, but the appendicitis isn't. Glick's desperate to get out from under the demand that he lose the case pronto so that David will go to jail, where vengeful real estate mogul Jules Kenworth can use his vulnerable position to keep putting pressure on the councilman. And the kid, insisting that he's innocent, refuses to take the deal. So, Herbie, who thought he'd be spending 10 minutes in court, ends up cross-examining witnesses whose testimonies he knows nothing about, and in the process, mightily though unwittingly, angering Tommy Taparelli, the fixer Kenworth has engaged to ensure a guilty verdict. Dazed and confused, Herbie can hardly wait to return to his Park Avenue penthouse to spend some quality time with his fiancée, Yvette Walker, an actress out of the Yale Drama School. Now, if only Yvette weren't really a call girl up to her neck in a scheme to fleece Herbie and leave him at the altar holding the bag. The weightless style is Woods, but the smartly engineered complications involving multiple malefactors who plot at serenely oblivious cross-purposes are right out of Hall's stories about sad sack private eye Stanley Hastings. Woods, who's often mysteriously immune to plotting, may have found the perfect partner. Again, that is called Barely Legal, and it's by the very popular author, Stuart Woods. Next, something by Danielle Steele, Dangerous Games. With her latest book, Dangerous Games, Danielle Steele once again shows that a romance novel cannot just be about slowly falling in love, about relationships, and about subtle passion. It can also be a tale of ambition, politics, corruption, and final justice. Centered around television journalist Alex Phillips and cameraman Ben Chapman, the story is a long, slow one that it's sometimes melancholic, mostly vibrant, and occasionally repetitive, but overall talks about a warm tale of friendship that inevitably blossoms into love. Spoiler alert, the first kiss between the protagonists happens only after page 250 and lovemaking after 10 more pages. The chapter set in New Delhi, India, ushers in a sense of familiarity. There are others are set in cities all across the world. Danielle does what she is best at, bringing the nuances of different relationships alive with her narrative style. The relationship between mother and daughter, work buddies, mature friends, office colleagues, husband-wife, and even politically motivated relationships, she presents it all in a very realistic and contemporary style. Alex, the 39-year-old fiery journalist who loves her mortally risky job, works on literally explosive news features worldwide. Trouble starts brewing when her boss assigns a story that is about investigating damning allegations against the Vice President of the United States, Tony Clark. Her meetings with the reclusive Olympia Foster, whose husband Bill was shot dead right in front of her, takes the story forward. Bill was one of the most respected senators in the USA and was destined for the presidency. Post his death, Olympia found solace in his best friend and fellow politician, Tony. Tony felt Olympia was the perfect partner for him and wanted to marry her after Ben was shot. But Tony's tender behavior and caring nature led her to trust him, and she began emotionally and otherwise depending on him for everything. The story picks up pace when Alex is asked to persuade Olympia to wear a wire and help the CIA eavesdrop on Tony. The stakes slowly rise, and the death threats begin. Alex's daughter, Faye, is injured. She and Ben invariably get closer, and their just work buddies relationship evolves. The politics, corruption, and final climax is cleverly woven into the book with the help of simple, easy, and engaging language. Slowly, Danielle lets all of the pieces of the puzzle fall together. And again, that book is called Dangerous Games, and it's by Danielle Steele. And you're listening to Heard Any Good Books Lately, produced by the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Thanks for joining me today. We're going to introduce right now a new feature on this program. It is called Burkhoff's Bookshelf. Collections librarian Joshua Burkhoff at the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped shares his picks, insight, and reviews of series, authors, and titles, both new and old, available here at the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. And this summary is available right there on their website, but I'm going to read it to you now. It's about a book called Lincoln in the Bardo by George Saunders. And I actually have the book number and all of that, and I'll give you that at the end here. This is one of the weirdest and yet most intriguing books I have read in a very long time, says Burkhoff. I'm not sure I could do the book justice by trying to summarize the plot, so I have quoted another source below. On February 22nd, 1862, 2 days after his death, Willie Lincoln was laid to rest in a marble crypt in a Georgetown cemetery. That very night, shattered by grief, Abraham Lincoln arrives at the cemetery under cover of darkness and visits the crypt alone to spend time with his son's body. Set over the course of that one night and populated by ghosts of the recently passed and the long dead, Lincoln in the Bardo is a thrilling exploration of death, grief, the powers of good and evil, a novel in its form and voice completely unlike anything you've read before. It's also, in the end, an exploration of the deeper meaning and possibilities of life, written as only George Saunders can, with humor, pathos, and grace. Now, here's a little bit more information about the book. Bardo is the Tibetan Buddhist name for a transition period between death and rebirth, and it seems to indicate, in this case, the bizarre purgatory inhabited by these ghosts. The supernatural chatter can grow tedious at times. The novel would have benefited immensely from some judicious pruning. But their voices gain emotional momentum as the book progresses, and they lend the story a choral dimension that turns Lincoln's personal grief into a meditation on the losses suffered by the nation during the Civil War and the more universal heartbreak that is part of the human condition. The ghosts are a motley lot reminiscent of the dispossessed and disenfranchised characters in Saunders' short stories. They include a soldier, a murderer, a disgraced clerk, a rape victim, a hunter who's killed more than 30 bears and hundreds of deer, an aggrieved scholar, a mother of three girls, a young man who tried to kill himself after the man he loved spurned his affections, and an older man who was struck in the head by a falling ceiling beam and died before he could consummate his marriage to his pretty young wife. Together, these voices create a kind of portrait of an American community, not unlike one in Edgar Lee Masters' 1915 classic Spoon River anthology, which was set in a fictionalized version of a small Illinois town. The poems in Spoon River were narrated from beyond the grave, by the dozens of souls sleeping on the hill in the local cemetery. One of those characters was Ann Rutledge, rumored to have been Lincoln's first love, and whose untimely death, reportedly of typhoid, at the age of 22, was said to be a source of his often melancholy outlook on the world. The similarities between Spoon River and Saunders' new novel extend well beyond the Lincoln assassination and the graveyard confessions. Like Sherwin Anderson's Winesburg, Ohio, from 1919, itself a notable influence on Saunders' early stories, and Thornton Wilder's Our Town from 1938, Lincoln in the Bardo appropriates Master's multi-voiced approach, using it to create a story that unfolds into a meditation on the dreams and disappointments of ordinary people, longing for connection, but often left feeling isolated and alone. Lincoln in the Bardo by George Saunders. And as Mr. Burkhoff mentions here in his write-up, you can order this title online through the book links at the top by calling the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped and requesting a copy, or by downloading the title from Bard. If you're not a patron of our library and are not eligible for our services, please contact your local public library to obtain a copy of this. And by the way, I don't know that you would remember this, but this is talking book number DB86941. But all you have to do is go online or call the library and they will be able to send this to you, whether you would like the large print book or the talking book, whichever you prefer. And I'll have the number of the library, the phone number, at the end of this program too. And we have time for one more quick book summary from some of the most popular books in the last couple of months at the Library for the Blind. Before we close the program today, this one is called Dirty Work by James Woods. Stone Barrington gets a taste of New York City's devious upper crust in this sleek and engaging mystery in the number one New York Times best-selling series. Here's the plot. Hired to prove infidelity in an heiress's marriage, Stone Barrington goes undercover, but the work turns dirty and catastrophic when the errant husband is found dead and the other woman disappears without a trace. Now Stone must clear his own good name and find a killer hiding among the glitterati of New York's high society. The book is called Dirty Works by James Woods. And that's just about all the time we have for this month's edition of Heard Any Good Books Lately. I'm George Douglas. I hope you enjoyed it. If you'd like more information about how to become a patron of the North Carolina Library for the Blind, you can simply Google or search for the North Carolina Library for the Blind. Or, as I mentioned a little earlier, you can call them toll-free at 1-888-388-2460. Again, that's 1-888-388-2460. You can also use these same numbers and website to join the Friends of the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped, and it is that wonderful organization that sponsors this monthly feature on books. This program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Heard Any Good Books Lately will be available right after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time.